Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Well, good morning. I'm Derek McGinty in for Roland Martin. Just ahead on News One Now, proof of trouble in Baltimore. The Department of Justice finds Baltimore City Police targeted blacks while on patrol. Our panel of experts will break down this report. Plus, we're going to hear from Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. Two-week cover-up. Los Angeles County Police now coming clean, admitting their SWAT team killed an innocent, mentally ill man. We're going to talk about the latest developments out there. Save Our Remaining Sons. Author and film producer Evie Rhodes joins us to talk about her campaign and plea to stop the tragedies and senseless violence in our communities. And actor John Mark Jeffries and I will talk about his National Economic Empowerment Tour. News One Now starts right now.
Conclude that there is reasonable cause to believe that BPD engages in a pattern or practice of conduct that violates the Constitution and federal anti-discrimination law.
In the wake of last year's death of Freddie Gray while in police custody, the Justice Department released a scathing report now proving that the Baltimore Police Department purposely targeted the city's black population. In the 163-page report released just yesterday, investigators pinpoint just how the department violated the rights of the people its officers were sworn to protect. That report is based on interviews with more than 500 people and reviews of thousands of pages of documents. One specific example that stood out is when a supervisor told a patrol officer to stop and question a group of young black men for no valid reason. And then he told the officer, and we quote now, make something up. Here's a look at more statistics mentioned in that report. In Baltimore, a city that is 63% black, the Justice Department found 91% of those arrested on discretionary offenses like failure to obey or trespassing were African Americans. Blacks make up 60% of Baltimore's drivers, but account for 82% of the traffic stops. And of the 410 pedestrians who were stopped at least 10 times in the 5.5 years of data that they took a look at, 95% of them were black. But city officials say that since the Freddie Gray case, transport vans have been retrofitted with proper restraints. And also, 26 of those policies have now been revised, including the use of force. And officials are working on a whole plan that would give residents a role in determining how officers who cross the line are punished. The commissioner also says several officers mentioned in that report for misconduct have already been fired. But the Justice Department says that is not enough.
And nearly everyone who spoke to us, from the Baltimore City Fraternal Order of Police, who showed us their 2012 report, Blueprint for Improved Policing, to the residents who shared serious concerns, everyone agreed that the Baltimore Police Department needs sustainable reform.
This report is not an indictment on every man and woman that has the privilege of wearing this uniform, this patch, and this badge. This report is, however, an indictment of those bad behaviors by a relatively small number of police officers over many, many years.
The problems in Baltimore didn't happen overnight or appear in a day. The pattern or practice that we found results from long-standing systemic deficiencies in the BPD.
I'm very, very concerned by some of the information contained in this detailed report. I have no tolerance for any person who is privileged enough to wear this uniform if they choose to engage in racist, sexist, discriminatory, or biased-based policing.
Whether in Baltimore or around the country, police reform won't happen overnight and or by chance. These problems were not created overnight. It's going to take time, and it's going to require focused effort and a sustained commitment.
To the citizens of Baltimore, our professional men and women will continue to serve you. We will continue to go after those who are choosing to harm our communities with guns, with drugs, with violence, and with other criminal acts. But we will do it in a lawful and respectful way.
NAACP President and CEO Cornell Brooks responded to the report. He says in a statement, and we quote, "While some may find this report shocking, it simply confirms what people living and working in Baltimore have known for years." He went on to say, the NAACP recognizes the release of the DOJ report as an opportunity for our communities to address the nationwide crisis in policing and seek concrete change. So, will this report make a difference in how police patrol our communities? Talking to me now on FaceTime in St. Louis, Reddit Hudson, the co-founder of the National Coalition of Law Enforcement Officers for Justice, Reform, and Accountability. And here in our studio, Davon Love, Director of Research and Public Policy, Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. And on today's panel, Tiffany Lofton, a campaign strategist and former USSA president, and David Swerdlick, an assistant editor for The Washington Post. All right, so this report is out. A lot of people are talking about it, but what's the message that's being sent?
Well, you used the right word, Derek. It's a scathing report. You know, it always bears repeating that police have a dangerous and difficult job. But when you read some of the summaries of what came out in this report, disproportionate stops in black neighborhoods, disproportionate stops with no probable cause or no arrest made or no charges found on people stopped and frisked, people strip searched in the open. What it suggests, and we've talked about this many times on this show, is that in this community, like other communities, you have a situation where not all police, but many police don't see their job as serving citizens. They don't see the people that they're stopping as people that they work for, and that's a problem.
And let's go to Reddit Hudson for just a second. As an officer and someone who's looking at this from far away, what's your reaction to what you saw happen in that report?
My initial reaction was the same as President Cornell William Brooks of the NAACP. For black people all over the country, this report really says that water is wet, fire is hot. This has been our lived experience for generations. And the issue for me is, it's not just Baltimore. If you pick any urban core environment in the country, go to any city in the country, this is what you have on the ground relative to the police and the black community. And we're going to have to find a way to bring systemic change beyond just even Department of Justice intervention, because Department of Justice can only be so many places at once. That's why we at NCLEOJ call for people who have come from marginalized communities, black communities, Latino communities, LGBT communities that work for these departments, that work in the criminal justice system. Now is our time to unify, to fight the institutional racism that's at the foundation of our criminal justice system and in police culture from coast to coast. And the last thing I want to say about what you just asked me, you pointed out the officer in the report, the sergeant, I believe, who directed his officers to make up charges to put on some black young men that they had stopped. He did that in front of a Department of Justice official. Think of the mentality. Think of the brazen devaluing and utter feeling of, I'll never be held accountable. Nothing can happen to me. Nothing can stop us from abusing your rights when I have a Department of Justice official with me when I direct you to violate this young man's rights. We have a problem in America, but it's going to be fixed.
When you talk about, though, the fact that the brazenness of this and the fact that people feel there is not accountability, how do you then turn that around to get folks on your side? Because you need folks in the department and throughout the department in the rank and file on your side to make this change, don't you?
Yes, you do. We have people in the department. This is what I'm saying. And we have enough to build a critical mass. I think there has to be enough of us willing and ready to challenge the system so that there is not the resulting isolation, retaliation, and other steps that are taken to discourage people from challenging the system. What you see is happens all over the country is one or two officers will challenge, but the rest fall back to see what's going to happen to those one or two. And of course, the retaliation, the demotions, the transfers to undesirable districts and assignments, all of that takes place. But if you have a critical mass of us, which we do, which we are calling to the forefront now to change this system and remake it, we have the truth on our side, obviously, as you look at the Department of Justice result. We have moral authority on our side. What's right is what's right. And now is our time to insist that the system be remade, not reformed, because we believe that the system is functioning exactly as it was designed to function, with legislated inequity in our laws and targeted enforcement in our communities. We want to be that change.
All right, Reddit, let's turn to our panel and talk about some of the things you brought up. First of all, let's talk to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a couple of things. One is, the first 6 months of this year, according to Think Progress, 532 people were killed by the police officers in this country. And so now we stand in August, and we are hearing a report, which our community, like you know, President Brooks had said and other folks have already said, this is exactly what the community had been saying. There is a element of democracy that we need to check here in this country where folks' voice feels like they're folks' voices are able to be able to address and talk about these issues and these topics on the front lines, and that the media is not just shooing it away. Out of that 532 people who have been killed by the police officers, a large number of them are white. So it's not just about we need people in the Department of Justice and we need black folks on the streets still. We need everybody else in this country to recognize that this issue is about all of us, and other media channels need to be able to cover and have this conversation as well. This should not be police versus black folks. This is about police officers and the system that was designed to attack, shut down, close, and silence and kill the people and citizens in this country.
Davis Worley.
Well, no, I mean, just what I was saying a few minutes ago, I think this really does, and, you know, partly to what Tiffany was just saying, there's a fundamental divide when you see this report and you see these kinds of Justice Department reports in so many places around the country between how officers are seeing citizens in their municipalities and how citizens are seeing police. You know, if officers need more resources, if they need more training, if they need different union contracts, that's something that city and municipal leaders should address. But at the same time, it has to be incumbent on law enforcement officers to understand that the citizens who they work for are not the problem.
One of the things that's missing in the DOJ report is the emphasis on the importance of civilians to be involved in every process of administering law enforcement, discipline, producing the policies and training and the like. And that's important because it is really the ability for police to police themselves that has allowed for law enforcement to be able to engage in the activities that the DOJ report suggests. And I think it's also important for us to note that the real target here is the fraternal order of police, because in legislative changes that have been attempted to be made, particularly in Maryland on a state level, the opposition has been the fraternal order of police and the name of protecting the officers' rights as workers. It's important for us to understand that if public safety is a public good, then the public has a right and responsibility to oversee the administering of law enforcement, because the deterrent to the behaviors we see in the DOJ report is people knowing that these officers are engaging in this behavior and knowing that there's a mechanism by which they could be held accountable within the apparatus of policing itself.
And we do know that Baltimore, like pretty much every other city that gets hammered by the DOJ, says, well, we've already put in place a lot of the changes that need to happen. Are you buying that, Davon?
Well, here's the problem, is that if you have police policing themselves, again, this is a situation where you can put in any new policies that you want, right? But law enforcement is going to be able to contort evidence, to be able to suppress certain kinds of information that will force them to be accountable, right? And so I think it's important for us, when we look at the substance of law enforcement reform, the central policy that has to be pursued is making it so that law enforcement is not able to investigate itself, to discipline itself, that you need civilian and participation, not just input, but civilian participation in the way that law enforcement is administered.
All right, Davon, listen, I want to thank you, and we'll get back to the rest of the panel, and I want to thank Reddit for joining us from St. Louis as well. We appreciate it. But we have to turn now to talk to Marilyn Mosby. She'll share her thoughts on the Department of Justice report. Marilyn Mosby, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it a great deal. First of all, your reaction, you're part of this system. And though you haven't been there long in terms of being a state's attorney, you've been a part of this for a while. What's your reaction to this report? Does it surprise you at all?
So I think what Cornell Brooks it pretty much already stated was that this is something that we've experienced in our communities, in this city. This is something that we know that we experience on a regular basis. So no, I'm not actually surprised about it one bit. I think it's not a surprise living in West Baltimore that, you know, police unconstitutionally stop, search, and arrest individuals. It's not surprising that, you know, that you would see some individuals be strip searched. It's shocking maybe for other folks, but when you live in the heart of West Baltimore, that's not shocking. What I think we have to do at this point is it's time to really focus on reform. It's not a I told you so sort of moment. This is one in which we really need to start to really address national policing reform in this country. And Baltimore has a unique opportunity to do so.
Now, I know you said it's not an I told you so kind of moment, and I know you're limited to what you can talk about regarding the case of Freddie Gray. However, Is this in some level a vindication for you and part of what you've been trying to tell people all along?
No, it's not. Again, it's not a matter of I told you so. This is not a matter of even vindication. This is a matter of, you know, exposing what has become a discriminatory policing policies in this country and actually addressing it. So for me, it's just you expose it. Now what do we do about it? It's time to reform it. It's time to address it, move past it, and make sure that our communities are safe and working with the police department.
You know, Baltimore's Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake said this report has nothing at all to do with the Freddie Gray case. Do you agree with that assessment?
So, I mean, that's her opinion. I can't, you know, argue with her opinion. But what I can tell you is that this investigation was launched 7 days after the announcement of the charges. And we were looking to cooperate with the Department of Justice in any way that we could. I think it's a matter of exposure. We've exposed some of the systemic issues that we were plagued with in prosecuting this case. And now we're talking about national policing reform. So yeah. I can't say anything about her opinion, but I do think it's a result of what we saw.
So you seem to be saying that when you decided to prosecute this case, you knew what you were up against. You knew that there were these problems involved in policing in Baltimore.
Well, I was a prosecutor in Baltimore City for over 6 years, even before I became the state's attorney. And living in the heart of West Baltimore, again, I've experienced, you know, discriminatory policing practices from my husband to myself personally. Mm. So this is not something that's new to me. And this is something that, you know, when I decided to become the state's attorney, I wanted to pursue my passion, make sure that we were applying justice fairly and equally to everybody, regardless of their age, their sex, or their occupation.
You know, one of the issues that comes up is the fact that as a state's attorney, as a chief prosecutor, you've got to work with the cops on
Absolutely.
This. And so you've got to strike a fine balance between keeping their trust and maintaining the trust of the community. Is that balance out of whack? Is there a bad blood between your office and the Baltimore Police Department?
And I have to say no, absolutely not. There's no sort of bad blood, because what I understand coming from five generations of police officers is that not every police officer is bad. And the majority of the Baltimore police officers are hardworking police officers that risk their lives day in and day out, take time away from their families to do their job. Recognizing that there are some bad apples, and, you know, as in any profession. But recognizing that when you apply justice fairly and equally to everybody, regardless of their occupation, when you say that nobody is above the law, you start to send a message to everybody, not just the police, but to the community, that this is going to be a fair and equitable system.
Back in 1999, according to this report, that's when the zero tolerance policies began that went on for a dozen years under Martin O'Malley, that partially caused this problem, that so much was based in on arrests and bringing people in and stopping, frisk and all this. Would you agree with that assessment? And how come a dozen years after that, the problem hasn't gotten better?
So when we look at what happened in March and in April, we have to look at, you know, the economic and racial divestment in our communities. You have to look at the sort of culmination of distrust among our law enforcement and our community. You have to look at the decades-old failed policies, and I don't think it's fair to just blame zero tolerance. Mm. There were a number of issues that were exposed even through the Department of Justice and the way that police deal and interact with community members that contributed to what we saw in April and in May. Mm. So it's not just, I think, one sort of policy that is the cause and the end-all be-all for what we saw in the unrest or what we see in this report. It's a culmination of all of that.
Mm. The report and the city of Baltimore says that they are going to promise major reforms, that they've already begun to do them. How do you manage expectations in terms of the amount of time these reforms are going to take and what's likely to actually happen?
So I think what we're seeing is this culture, and I think the Department of Justice really hit it on the nail on the head. This is not something that's going to happen overnight, but how do you start doing that? Well, you start holding people accountable. And when you hold people accountable and you show that people are not above the law, you expose those systemic issues, and then you address them. So now when we talk about, you know, the way that police officers interact, and we've talked about some of the reforms, you know, whether they're ever going to put another person in a wagon, head first, feet shackled, and handcuffed, that should never take place again. There's cameras inside vehicles. You know, whether there's an issue about the person being stopped or searched or arrested. You know, there's supposed to be full implementation of body cameras. So there are a number of reforms that can take place, but you have to actually be willing and able to hold people accountable. And unfortunately, when we look at what the police department has done over a number of years, there's been no oversight, there's been no training, and they've never held those small number of bad actors accountable. And so that's what we're seeing the result of.
All right. Marilyn Mosby, Baltimore State's Attorney, thank you. We appreciate you joining us this morning. Very great conversation. All right, coming up, cover up, exposed. The L.A. County Police Department forced to admit and explain how they shot and killed an innocent, mentally ill man. Save Our Remaining Sons, author and film producer Evie Rhodes is here to talk about her campaign and plea to stop the tragedies and the senseless violence in our communities. For the latest news, stay up to date and informed at news1.com, and you can hit me up with your thoughts on Twitter at McGinty Man or at News One or on our News One Facebook page. It's 20 minutes after the hour. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Officers in Salt Lake City under fire this morning following the shooting of a Black teenager. Two officers shot Abdullahi Mohammed four times. They put him in a coma. That was back in February. Well, the then 17-year-old did survive, but we don't know how his health is as of today. Meantime, on Monday, the district attorney cleared those officers of any wrongdoing. Well, that prompted protests against the decision. The officers say they believe Mohammed was about to seriously injure or kill a man that he was fighting with a metal broomstick. Mohammed, now 18 years old, is charged with aggravated robbery and possessing drugs with intent to distribute. Protesters are demanding investigators release the body cam footage of that shooting. And civil rights lawyers have teamed up to sue more than a dozen St. Louis area cities, accusing them of purposely targeting poor Black people for minor traffic infractions to fill up the jails. The lawsuit was filed 2 years to the date after Officer Darren Wilson shot and killed 18-year-old Michael Brown. Now, during the investigation following Brown's death, the Justice Department revealed a policing system in Ferguson that treated residents as potential offenders and sources of revenue rather than constituents that should be protected. Well, the lawsuit alleges the towns have conspired as a group to arrest drivers who are too poor to pay their traffic fines and then added more fines and jail sentences when the drivers can't pay up. Attorneys representing the plaintiffs call the method a, quote, debtor's prison scheme that has no place in American society, end of quote. The lawsuit calls for policy changes and for money to compensate the plaintiffs. Now, before teenagers in Illinois can get their driver's licenses, they now have to take a course on how to handle being stopped by the police. Governor Bruce Rauner signed the bill into law last week. The goal? Prevent teenagers from panicking when they get pulled over and also from doing anything that might seem like a red flag.
My hope is that if we uniformly require that driver's education include the protocol and what is expected when you interact with a police officer, that things will not escalate.
Initially, everyone goes for their driver's license, be it in your wallet, in your purse, and that move itself can cause alarm to an officer walking up to the car.
The Secretary of State's office will develop those guidelines. The new curriculum will be put in place for the 2017-2018 school year. And some very sad news out of the world of journalism. Another sports icon has passed away.
Congratulations to the national champion, Texas Longhorns!
ESPN sportscaster John Saunders died yesterday. He was 61 years old. He joined ESPN some 30 years ago. He covered college football, basketball, and pro hockey. Born in Canada, he played hockey for some of Montreal's junior hockey leagues before he pursued his career in broadcasting. He was known for a hearty laugh and a passion for the V Foundation, a cancer research organization that he co-founded. The cause of his death has not yet been announced. Well, coming up, the L.A. County Police Department in hot water after fessing up to shooting and killing an innocent, mentally ill man. We'll talk about how that one's shaping up. And a successful inner-city teacher lays out his curriculum for getting urban students excited about learning and utilizing Black culture. For the latest news, stay up to date and informed at news1.com and hit me up with your thoughts on Twitter at Roland S. Martin, or actually it should be at McGinty Man for me, or at News One or on our News One Facebook page. It is 25 minutes after the hour. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
Reverend Jesse Jackson, you have one vote. Use it, don't abuse it. Use that vote and keep hope alive.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
I'm hurt. I wonder why they had to take someone very special to me. He was very kind. He was kind-hearted. That was my love. And I just wonder why Compton SWAT did what they did to a special someone. It hurts dearly. It hurts. Right. Black lives matter. I just want justice for my baby brother.
Pure devastation there from the sister of Donnell Thompson, a mentally ill man shot by an L.A. County SWAT team July 28th. Initially, officers said they pursued the 27-year-old because they suspected him of being involved in a carjacking that occurred in a nearby Compton neighborhood. The carjacking suspect, though, had engaged in a gunfire battle with the cops prior to running away and was hiding in a neighboring home. While in search for that suspect, police in armored trucks came in contact with Thompson. He was sleeping in a stranger's yard. After he did not respond to their commands, they detonated a flash grenade. They hit him with foam bullets. Cops then say he ran toward them, and that's when a deputy on top of an armored vehicle shot him with an assault rifle, hitting him twice in the torso and killing him. Well, nearly 2 weeks later, after that initial report, the department has come clean about this case.
We have no physical evidence that connects Mr. Thompson to the carjacked vehicle or to any assault by gunfire on our deputies. This is a terribly devastating event. I think the department clearly wants to provide answers to the Thompson family. We completely understand and agree with their desire to do that. We feel a responsibility to do that. And we also feel a responsibility for questions that we have as an organization and a department, and that will take place.
Well, despite the L.A. County PD's professed efforts to be transparent about this, Thompson's family is continuing to hold out for those answers they talked about.
It's so much, all in one. And how do you expect us to act when we're patient and we're waiting and we're waiting? We're not going crazy, we're waiting patiently. Twiddling thumbs. I'm shaking, I'm scared. I'm scared for my brothers. I'm scared for my family members. And it shouldn't be like that. It shouldn't. I don't understand that.
The family attorney has filed a federal civil rights claim against the LA County and will also file a lawsuit. The family expected to hold a press conference sometime this afternoon. Still here with my panel to weigh in on all this, Tiffany Lofton, David Zwerdlich, and Davon Love. You know, this is one of those cases where it's just not enough to say mistakes were made, right?
No, absolutely. Look, if the facts as have been reported out turn out to be the facts of the case, you have to ask yourself, even if you're trying to give police the benefit of the doubt, this isn't a case where they came around the corner, based on what we know, and was caught off guard by the guy. First the foam bullets, he was asleep. It makes you wonder whether there was proper supervision, whether someone was making a decision in this case to try and evaluate whether police had to use deadly force.
What's the procedure? These guys are in armored vehicles. Right. The guy who shot him was sitting on top of an armored vehicle. How is there a threat from a man running who you don't see a weapon or anything? How was he threatening?
Well, I mean, I would say two things. One, I think we live in a society structured on the system of racism and white supremacy from which people have internalized criminal notions of people of African descent in a way that caused people to respond in extreme and violent ways. And I think this is an example of how that's carried out. But I think the other issue that we have to take into consideration is that we have to ask ourselves the question, is law enforcement as it's currently constituted necessary? I mean, there are community mediation organizations, community patrol organizations that if we were to invest in their ability to be able to address situations like this, right, then you wouldn't need law enforcement that has a military attitude in terms of addressing these issues to be involved.
That's all well and good until you're being carjacked or somebody's breaking in your house and you're not going to call the community organization. You're going to call 911.
This should be the last resort. My argument is that we need to make sure that community organizations can address people in situations where there doesn't need to be a military response.
Tiffany?
Yeah, this touches home for me personally. I'm actually from Compton, Gardena area, Rosecrans and 138th in Maine. And to know that this is one of the first times I've ever heard a department or a police official stand in front and say, we made a mistake, I think that changes the narrative. And we just got finished talking about Baltimore and the police reform that needs to happen with the department there. It should not take another federal investigation or any other extra efforts to have to repeat the process that we've seen in these other cities where the uprisings for Black Lives Matter have taken place and where they've happened. And we also know that the men that they were looking for got arrested at the same time that they killed this brother. So why are they happening at the same time? They were basically one police officer's set out to respond to a call, and they got two different black guys, and one of them ended up dead, and the other one's in the jail right now.
But can't you make the argument that mistakes are going to happen, right? You're dealing with police. They're in very sketchy situations. That they did shoot.
What is sketchy about a man sleeping on the grass?
They did. They shot the foam bullets at him. They tried to deal with him non-lethally, and then he ran at them. Obviously, too much force there. But is it just a mistake, or is it an endemic systemic problem?
Well, I would say this to your point. Maybe police in this jurisdiction, other jurisdictions need more training, but they already do have some training. And based on what's been reported, the young man who was killed was exhibiting signs of experiencing mental illness. Some of that training should kick in. The other thing I wanted to bring up regard to what Davon said before the break was that anytime an officer is charged with a crime, whether it's Freddie Gray or anything else, they are entitled to due process, reasonable doubt. But if we're just talking about someone staying on a police force and keeping their job, you don't get a jury of 12 to decide whether you keep your job. If you don't know how to properly police, people should be held accountable at a minimum with being removed from police force or disciplined in a meaningful way, not just reprimanded or the spokesperson coming out and saying, we're sorry.
Yeah, so is that a civilian complaint review board sort of situation? Would that ameliorate this problem?
Well, so that's one element, is that you have a civilian review board that might exist outside of the law enforcement agency, but you also need a mechanism within the apparatus of the police department itself. Right, that would allow them to have access to all the information. Because if you look at most internal affairs in police departments, they're very insular, right? And there's only certain information you're able to get access to. So you need someone outside of the industry of policing to be involved in that process of getting the information that can be let out to the public so that there's greater accountability for law enforcement.
You know, but Tiffany, you did say it seemed like the LA County PD had come a long way just by getting out front and admitting a mistake. Do you think that there is a healing process going on there?
Well, the healing process and us responding to these constant tragedies is very hard. You can't heal if you keep getting shot. And so for me, I would also advise folks check out the Movement for Black Lives 3 days ago just released an amazing platform that includes some of the stuff around civilians being able to be a part of the processes, what police officers and reform should do, zero tolerance policies and how they should be taken down. And so I advise folks to check out that comprehensive platform because that can give us some solutions for not only in LA and in Baltimore, but from across this entire country, how we can solve some of these problems.
Tiffany Lofton, Davon Love, David Zwerdlich, thanks guys. We appreciate it. Well, award-winning author and film producer Evie Rhodes has written several books about the tragedies and the senseless violence in our communities. Even her latest novel, turned movie, Expired, highlights a mother's struggle to cope with the death of her son. Well, on May the 20th, Evie's 24-year-old son, James Rhodes, was shot and killed in Camden, New Jersey. And this tragic experience has motivated Evie to make a, quote, plea and a call to action to save our remaining sons. She's also launched an initiative on breaking the cycle of black male death in America. Evie Rhodes is here right now to talk about her initiative and her call for action. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
It's good
Thank you for having me, Evie.
It's our pleasure. First of all, can you talk a little bit about your own journey from grief to activism?
It's been a very, very, a very tough situation because as a mother, I did have that grieving process. But at the same time, for me, that element of grief just turned huge. Mm. I began thinking not about just my son, but about all of the other mothers and the sons that they have lost, about the fact that, you know, we have black males that are not living to be 25 in this day and age. I mean, there's just so many of them. And so my process from grief to activism, they're kind of merged. The grief is still there, but I've been motivated to, awareness needs to be here. Mm. We need to have awareness. We need to have this conversation. We need to figure out what the backstory is.
So how emotional is it for you when you see the video of other families and mothers going through exactly the same thing you went through?
It's tough. I people have been writing into me and talking to me about different situations, and it is very tough. It's like each situation, I'm living it over and over again, not only for my own son, but also for the sons of the mothers of other young men that have been killed, and many of them saying that they have no outreach, that they're alone, that they feel like they have nowhere to go, they don't hear any awareness about it, no one's talking about it. It's an instant. In other words, you know, right now it's important because it happened today. And then after that, it goes away. And this is a gap that I think needs to be filled nationwide, and where I want to raise my voice, because I don't think that losing the lives of young black men is something that should be just today. We have to deal with this. We have, this nation has to look at it, and we have to do what's necessary.
You know, so many black men, though, a far great majority of them are killed by other black men. And that's something you, are you also raising your voice regarding that?
Yes. I think that the violence is senseless. But my issue is that there has to be some responsibility. And the thing that is really bothering me is the backstory to that. There are so many of young black men that are murdering each other. But, you know, I'm looking at what is creating this circumstance? What's creating this mindset? You know what I mean? Where do we start? And more importantly, what does it take, you know what I mean, to change the mindset so that before one of these young men pulls this trigger, that there's a mechanism or something else that kicks in for that moment in time that might be a preventative measure to losing all of these lives. I think there are a lot of extenuating circumstances in America that are lending to the point of execution before that young man or woman pulls that trigger.
Award-winning author and film producer Evie Rhodes, you're asking a lot of important questions and hoping to provide some answers too. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
We appreciate
it. Thank you for having me.
Well, coming up, an urban educator talking about teaching success achieved by celebrating the culture of the students. Our actor Mark John Jeffries is here. He'll break down how you can become financially empowered. 42 minutes after the hour, stick around.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Well, this segment is brought to you by the University of Phoenix, recognizes that one-size education does not work for every student. In the last 10 years, we have seen a ramp up on the pushback against culturally biased education and everything from learning materials to standardized test questions. Dr. Christopher Emden has been on the forefront using culturally specific curricula to find teaching success with students in urban communities. He is author of For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood. And he joins us now on FaceTime from New York City to talk about some of his teaching techniques. Welcome, Christopher. Interesting stuff.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for having me. Deeply appreciate it.
Yeah, so when you talk about culturally relevant teaching, you've been using guest rappers in the classroom. Talk about that and how that works.
You know, absolutely. You know, we find in the research we've conducted across urban spaces, you know, what demographic appeals most to young people who are disengaged from schools. So you have kids who are completely disinterested in what's going on in the classroom, but the minute they leave the school building, they throw their headphones on, or they go home and watch videos, or they get on their social media, and they're following these rappers and these sort of musical icons. And so the idea was, if we want the same kind of engagement that they have with those artists in the classroom, that excitedness, that motivation, you know, why not bring these folks into the classroom? What we found is that a lot of our rap artists that we perceive to be inherently negative or violent or misogynistic or hyper-capitalist are actually deeply interested in education. They want to give back to the community. They want to be positive role models, and they just don't know how. Mm. And so what we've been able to do is bring some of these artists into schools to serve as a motivator to young people, but also a way through which we can have them engage in really challenging academic content.
We got to bring...
So we brought... Pardon me?
Go ahead. I was going to say, go ahead, finish what you were going to say.
Yeah, so we know we brought a lot of amazing people. You know, my grad students and I have been able to bring Master P to a school in Brooklyn, and he was able to teach about financial literacy and mathematics in a way that the teachers just couldn't. You know, Kendrick Lamar has come to a school in New Jersey to teach students about poetry and using meter and rhyme and alliteration. Jizza from Wu-Tang has been able to come and teach science. And so, you know, we have these amazing artists who are brilliant minds who can now become educators and really engage and hook young people.
All right. I got to bring my panel in on this conversation because I remember when I was in school and little, and, you know, there were times when I was bored and didn't want to be there either. But we got to learn, and it had nothing to do with rappers or pop culture. What's different about what's happening today? Or is there something different, David?
If they're getting results, great. It can't just be about broadening and diversifying the curriculum. But if he's getting results and he says he's getting results, I'm for it.
Here's what I'll say. When I was in school, I took AP classes, and I know all my schools are going to look at me right now. Those textbooks were very tailored to a certain audience and only told one side of the history of this country. And so to be able to engage students from across the country, which I have done that work for the last like 7 years, you have to make it relatable to them. Mm. And if they are listening to Kendrick Lamar, who I love to death, if you are listening to Kendrick Lamar and you bring those folks into the classroom, the students are going to be more excited and motivated to say, okay, this brother right here is not only talking about this in his song, but he cares about science.
Isn't that I don't want to call it a Band-Aid approach, but it's a small thing that everybody's not going to get a hold of, right? You can't do that for 2 million students, right? You can do that for a few classrooms, David.
Well, I mean, I think a part of the issue is that when we look at education, is supposed to teach people who receive it how to interact with the world around them. They're supposed to give them a greater sense of themselves and the relationship to the global body politic. And so a lot of the things that the gentleman brought up that he brings into the classroom are one element as to how students are able to self-act. They need to see themselves in their education process. If we take a picture of us on the panel, the first thing you're going to look for is yourself. Right. And so I think it's important for us to understand education as primarily needing to help students be able to self-actualize in a way where their educational process is something they can take ownership of.
Let me go back to Christopher and put that same question. How do you expand what you're doing to something that can be used for everybody?
Yeah. You know, so we have a project called Science Genius, for example. So it's not just the artists and Science Genius. What we do is we have young people across schools, across the country, actually now across the world, who are crafting their own songs or writing their own raps about academic content. And we do this work not to sacrifice the academic rigor. So you have to be able to make sure that you understand the content on a high level. You have to incorporate mathematical ideas and themes and interesting concepts, but you get to craft your own song. We find that if we spend the funding to put a $5,000 recording studio in a school, it's actually more of an investment than if you spent $200,000 on a computer lab, because young people want to go into the recording studio and create a song around the content that they're learning. So what we're trying to do is we just really shift what the emphasis is on. The emphasis has oftentimes been on academic rigor and associating rigor with sort of rigor mortis and boredom and disengagement. And we say, listen, you could be academically rigorous and still enjoy the process and want to do it and be engaged and see yourself as, you know, as having an identity that, you know, you could be cool and have swag and also be brilliant and musical and artistic at the same time. You don't have to segment aspects of your identity that you can actually do all at once. And that's the larger message. We could do that writ large across the country.
Christopher Edmond, I love it. Thank you so much. Not rigor mortis. I'm very much in favor of that. We appreciate your time this morning. All right, coming up, folks, my discussion with actor Mark John Jeffries. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Yara Shahidi from Black-ish. You have one vote. Use it.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
His first acting gig was the title role in the movie Losing Isaiah. Back then, he was only 4 years old, but he has been acting ever since. And most recently, in the mystery flick Nerve, which is currently in your neighborhood theater. Now, actor Mark John Jeffries has taken a break from the silver screen to share the tips and tricks to his multi-million-dollar financial success. He's got a 12-city National Economic Empowerment Tour going on right now, and he's in the studio with us now to talk about what he calls the Millionaire Complex Tour. Wow. Mr. Jeffries, welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Appreciate it.
Good
Thank
to have you.
Having me.
Millionaire Complex Tour. First of all, how did you come up with the idea and what made you decide to share it?
Really, the idea kind of just festered from the need. You know, I have my own acting school in New York, and through helping certain people attain skills and help them take the next step in their careers, I realized that a lot of people have realistic goals but unrealistic ways about achieving them. And sometimes thing that people don't have is information. They have the drive, they have the determination, but information changes your mindset, you know. So it was definitely something that was missing in my students, and I figured, wow, if this is missing in New York City where everything is so accessible, imagine in these smaller cities where they don't have any kind of programs or any kind of activities or curriculums to help them get along the right track. So as a result, the Millionaire Complex Tour kind of festered and different elements started being added until it became what it is today.
12 cities.
Yeah.
All right. Now let's talk about your own career. Mm-hmm. How have the values and ideas that you put forth to people in your seminars, How do they, how have they helped you?
Okay, well, for me, a lot of the things that I teach is more about being proactive. You know, a lot of times people, they want to do things. They say, I want to become an actor. I want to become, I want to get a starring role on this show. I want to become in movies and projects and things like that. But they never actually take those steps. Mm. And one thing is that my father and my family have always been behind me. And since I was younger, they've like pushed me to be where I am today, you know, and it doesn't come with sitting on your hands. It doesn't come with procrastination. It comes with getting up and actually doing it. So mm-hmm. one of the biggest values that I'm going to teach is once you have the information, you got to run with it. You can't just be a dreamer. A dream doesn't turn into reality on its own. A dream has to become a plan, a goal, and a goal has to have a plan, and then you have to actually take those steps.
All right, so do you charge people for coming to these seminars?
No, we're not going to be charging. That's the thing. It's going to be a sponsored tour.
Right, so yeah. People get to come free just to get the information. Mm-hmm. In fact, you're giving out grants, correct?
Yes, $2,000 small business grants for entrepreneurs.
Right, right. So when you talk about helping people get to their success, why was it important to you to spread this gospel?
Well, for me, I like educating. I feel that when you educate somebody, when you teach a man to fish, it has a lasting impact. And a lot of times, as influencers or celebrities or whatever the case is, we influence people to follow certain trends, but we never actually help them to better themselves. Mm. So it was just a need for it. You know, it was a need. My mom is an educator. My dad is the type of person where if anybody asks us a question about anything, he'll give them a 2-hour lecture so they can get it done. So it's in the family. It's in my family gene. And I know that there's so many people out there that they have the talent. And they just don't have any guidance, you know? So the Millionaire Complex Tour is to change that mindset. It's to give them the mentality they need to take steps forward.
You know, a lot of people would say, this is the age of information. Mm-hmm. I can Google anything, and I can find out information. What is it they can't find on the web that you're going to give them?
They can't find... I would say this. The web doesn't give you proven success. The web gives you people that may have written a blog about somebody else that did it. The web may give you unrealistic ways of achieving something. If you go on the website right now and say, how to become Will Smith, they'll probably put out different things. Being a big movie like Independence Day, but how do you do that?
Right.
You know, so the thing that I could give them is the experience. I've been doing this for 26 years. I have over 50 TV and film credits. So with that experience, I'm really sharing with people the growth and the struggle and the real business aspect of the industry.
You know, part of the problem for some of these sorts of things that people put out there is that there's no realism to it. In other words, if I come in and I'm 5'2" and I say I want to be a basketball star, well, maybe I need to rethink.
Exactly.
You know, so would you ever tell somebody, look, part of this is realistic expectations.
Yeah. At my school in New York, I have some students, right? And I feel that there's beauty in everybody, but everybody is not beautiful. And I have some students that's always trying to be the attractive person in the scene.
We all want to be the attractive person.
I just had to stop. I was like, all right, you're not performing for your mom. Your mom think you cute, all right? You about 50 years old, 3 teeth in your mouth, and you weigh about 300-400 pounds. You're not Denzel. Stop flirting with everybody. You can be somebody's love interest, but you're not going to be everybody's love interest.
So you don't have a problem telling people the realistic assessment of what they need to do?
Not at all, because when you let people live in a falsality, they waste their time. And time is the one commodity that we can't regain in life.
All right,
you lose money, love. All of that you can regain. Time, you can't.
That's a fair assessment. Let's talk about what folks have to do to get one of those $2,000 grants that you were talking about.
Well, we want to see business plans. You know, a lot of times people are ready to do things, but they don't have a smart way of going about it. So the money is not going to go to waste. We want to see business plans. We want to see how far they've structured it on their own. And then based on that, that'll show us if they are qualifying for the grant.
And who were some of the celebrities? Because I hear you have some big names coming in.
Yes, yes, yes. So far, I've invited Tyson Beckford, Natori Norton, Rotimi, that's on Power, DJ Webstar, Little Mama, the rapper Mano, Lenny Green came on as of late, Angela Yee, few talk show hosts. So, and it's actually some bigger names that right now are tentative, so we just waiting.
Absolutely. Folks who can tell folks straight up how they did it and how it can apply to their own situation.
Yes.
Actor Mark John Jeffries, great conversation, man.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Definitely.
We appreciate
Thanks for
you.
Having me.
All right.
Pleasure.
And I'm Derek McGinty. This is News One Now. We're going to be right back.
Hi, I'm Bob Johnson. You only have one vote. Please use it.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin. Every weekday morning at 7 on
Now TV for One. Our One Vote campaign, I've got the last batch of voting registration deadlines for you. First up, South Dakota. Residents there cannot register online. You have to register by mail or in person by October 24th. In Tennessee, online registration also not allowed. The deadline to register via the mail or in person, October 11th. It looks like government officials in Texas are taking notes from those in Tennessee. Online registration, a no-go there, too. And you have to be there by October 11th to register by mail or in person. Heading west now to Utah. The deadline to register by mail is October 9th. Folks there do have a bit more time to go online, though, or in person with the November the 1st deadline. Now, on to Vermont. If you live there, your deadline is November 2nd. All right, rolling south to Virginia, residents there have until October 17th to register. And if you live in Washington State, you've got until October 10th to register, but you can do it online or by the mail. Folks choosing to register in person have a bit more time. Halloween is the deadline in Washington. Here in the nation's capital, residents have until October 11th to register online and by mail. The deadline to register in person is October the 8th. If you live in West Virginia, your deadline is October 18th. In Wisconsin, the deadlines are all over the place. Online registration not available. Residents have until October 19th to register in by mail, and the deadline for in-person registration is November the 8th. Rounding us out, another state where the deadlines are all over the place, Wyoming. If you live there, you cannot register online. You have until October 25th to do it by mail. The deadline in person is November 8th.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.